So thank you so much for coming to Liberating Data with Interactive Charts. This is just one of the most exciting things that's going on in the world of technology today, but to be truthful, I mean, it's rarely that you really hear about it. So I think that I feel really happy that you've all come here today. I know that there's other things that you could be attending, and I think you'll be glad that you did, because of the importance of what this change is in our world. Now, I'm Ross Perez, and I work for a company called Tableau Software. And we make a really amazing product called Tableau Public that allows people to put data on the web for free. So essentially my role with Tableau is to help journalists and bloggers and nonprofits take their data and turn it into something that people can digest and understand and then place it on the web. So I get the chance and the opportunity and the privilege to work with different organizations like MapLight.org, The Wall Street Journal, Wired, Gizmodo, and others, and work with their data and turn it into something that is amazing and interactive and digestible. So to kind of understand this entire space, in the space of putting interactive data onto the web, I'm going to go through a couple different pieces of information. I'm going to show you different tools that you can use to put data on the web. I'm going to show you examples of visualizations that I think are pretty amazing. And a couple of them are Tableau, but this is really a lot bigger than just one company. So I'm going to spend most of the talk just talking about what these important changes are and how they're going to affect the world that we live in. Now, it's easy to feel like we are surrounded by data and that, you know, we're constantly interacting with it. But the truth is that, you know, we're still kind of living in this world that's divorced from data in a way. You know, it's not the 1970s anymore, but when was the last time you really, you know, interacted with data in a way that was inspiring or interesting or drew you in and made you feel like it was a fun experience? It's just one of those things that it never strikes you as something that we should have and it should be that way, because we've always interacted with data just like this. We've interacted with data in the abstract, in the just in not ways that we typically think of interacting with things on the web now. I mean, if you ponder, you know, all of the different technologies that and pieces of information that we can put on the web. We can put text on the web so easily. We can put images on the web so easily. We can put video on the web so easily. And yet putting data on the web and sharing it with people is still an enormous challenge. We're still stuck essentially in the 1970s, where we've just got a spreadsheet, an image maybe of, you know, a pie chart that we got from Excel, and that's really about it. Now, to kind of illustrate how important it is to take data and make it interactive and make it interesting, you really have to go back, well, about 15 or 20 years, really 15 years, to a time when video was just being introduced to the web. Now, this was kind of the first technology that allowed people to put video on the web that was widespread and adopted in a widespread way. And it's the Real Networks Real Video Player. Now, I'm not sure if anybody remembers interacting with this, but it was not the most inspiring experience. Essentially, you would see this on a website and you'd press play, and then you'd wait for about 15 minutes while it buffered. And then eventually you'd see this really crappy video at like 10 frames a second that would show you whatever it is that you're looking at. And of course, the problem with this isn't just that the quality was low and that the technology was new. It was simply not accessible. You know, in the 10 years ago, 12 years ago, I mean, video on the web was really for the enterprise. It wasn't for everybody. I mean, in truth, there was probably only 5% of the population that really knew how to put video on the web, and of those people, probably only 1% felt comfortable with putting video on the web. And that was really an enormous problem, but it didn't seem like a problem at the time. It seemed like, oh, well, we can't put video on the web. Well, whatever. We'll get on with life and it's no big deal. Now, there's a couple reasons why this was so difficult and what really compounded the difficulty of putting data on the web. First is that simply it costs too much. You'd literally have to have thousands of dollars worth of equipment to take video in its non-digital form and turn it into something that you could put on the web. And of course, if you were a larger organization and you wanted a lot of people to see your video, or even if you were just a normal person who wanted a lot of people to see your video, you simply had to spend a lot of money on the servers to be able to actually handle the traffic. You had to do everything yourself. It was all hosted by you, so to speak. And that made it extremely difficult for people to adopt video on the web. Similarly, and along the same lines, it was hard to use. So just think about all the things that you had to do 10 or 12 years ago to get data on the web. You had to take it from its analog form. You had to digitize it. Then you had to compress it. And when you put it on the web, you had to make a different output for every single size of video that you wanted to have played. It seems so crazy now because we're so used to putting video on the web just so easily and seamlessly in different sizes, different frame rates, etc. But at this time, you really had to do all of it manually. And who's going to do it? It usually came down to hiring somebody to take this video and turn it into something that you could get on the web. And the truth is that it's frustrating, especially in this digital and modern age, to have to ask somebody else to do something for you that you feel should be really simple. The last one's pretty obvious. It wasn't any fun. Now, that maybe was an impediment to companies that were trying to put data on the web, but to individuals, that's a pretty big roadblock. I mean, why are you going to take the time out of your day to go and actually do something like this and to put video on the web and just not any fun? So it's just simply not worth it. And of course, we all know that what the end of the story is. Now video on the web is interactive, it's fun, it's useful, and we are so used to the idea of just going and seeing video and interacting with it in just this easy and seamless way and embedding videos that we love onto our own blogs or websites. It's just simple, seamless, easy. And of course, the reasons why YouTube has been so successful is because they've made it accessible. Like I was saying, the technology was there 10 or 12 years ago, maybe not quite as good, but at the same time, you could get the video on the web, but it simply wasn't possible for 90% of the population. And of course, YouTube took that problem. They made it easy to use. They made it literally so simple for anybody to take video that they had, whether it's just a simple camera phone video or whether it's something that they've recorded on their camcorder at home or whether it's something that's been professionally edited and mastered. It's so simple. It's the easiest part of working with video now is putting it on the web, which is kind of funny to think about when just so recently, 10, 12 years ago, it was nigh on impossible for most people and simply something that you didn't see. Of course, the second thing is it's completely free. Now, I don't have to explain economics to you. Everybody understands that free tools are much easier to be adopted by a wider proportion of people. And obviously, that's a great reason for some of the success that YouTube has had. The last thing, of course, is that it's tons of fun. So we want to put video on the web. We want to take these videos that we've taken with our camera phone. We want to put them on the web. We want to share them. We want people to comment on them. We want people to interact with them and embed them on their site. And we want people to tweet them. And we understand that this process of taking video and putting it into the hands of the internet or just putting it on the internet is such a powerful thing. And yet, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, it was just one of those things that you never even thought of doing. We don't need it. It's no big deal. So coming back to data, I know it was a little bit of a detour, but I just wanted to illustrate that we're in the same place now that we were with video 10 or 12 years ago. It's hard to recognize how much we need to put data on the web and how important it is for us to be able to consume all of the data that's around us. And think about this in another way as well. So with video, you don't necessarily interact with video every day. In fact, I would say that I probably upload a video to YouTube maybe once a month, that may not be very much for some of you, but I would imagine that that's probably a pretty decent average. I mean, it's just not something that you need to do very often. And yet, it's such an integral part of the internet today and the way that people see and interact with information on the internet is a video is a key piece of that. But think about your interaction with data. So you wake up in the morning, you check your cell phone, that data record, that's data that's being recorded by the cell phone company. You flip on the lights, that's being recorded by the light company. I can get a printout, a CSV, a comma-separated spreadsheet of all of my different usage for every single day of the past year just for my electricity usage. And you wouldn't think that, you wouldn't even know unless you looked into it, but everything that we do is being recorded. And it's not just the things that we do, it's also the places that we are and the people that we're interacting with. When you walk out the door in the morning, you can find data on the air quality in your city. You can find data on crime statistics. You can find data on elections and different factors of the government around the area that you live. And so data is pervasive in our society, but it's simply not something that we even think of putting on the web. It's just one of those things where it's like, well, I guess you can take a file, you can put an Excel file up and people can download it, or you can make an Excel chart, or you can make an HTML table if you only have a couple of records of data. It doesn't make any sense that we have all of this data around us and that we're interacting with it constantly, or we're creating data constantly when I say interacting, but we can't put it on the web. We can't. It's very difficult to really create even a simple chart like this. I mean, this is a, 15-step process in Excel? And it doesn't make any sense. It should be easy to do. And the good thing is that, of course, it has become easier over time to do. Now, one of the things, this is where I'm going to kind of show you guys a couple of examples that I love and think really embody this idea that putting data on the web is important. And to really understand the genesis of all these different tools that I'm going to show you, well, three different tools I'm going to show you, you have to understand the beginning of interactive data on the web, which is, of course, Flash. Now, when I'm talking about Flash, I'm also talking about, in general, about technologies that essentially require programming or web development in order to embed them online. So HTML5, Flash, etc. And in any case, when Flash came out and people were actually able to put data on the web, it was really an enormous leap forward in a lot of ways. It allowed organizations that had the resources and the talent, like the New York Times, to put amazing interactive visualizations on the web. Now, let me get into a couple of examples that I think are really indicative of why we need better access to data. Now, this first one that I'm going to show you is a Flash visualization, and I'm sure, how many people have seen this? Gapminder? Okay, good, yeah. So, I'll be relatively brief since a lot of people have seen it, but this is one of the most amazing visualizations that I've ever seen, and it doesn't seem like it at first, and that's the thing with data. Sometimes you need to kind of play with it a little bit. You can't just look at a static chart and say, oh, that's awesome. Sometimes you want to interact and you want to know more and you want to dig in, and this single chart has easily 10,000 stories that can be told just from this one single chart, but the main story is about the development and of really the modern world, about the Industrial Revolution, about the technology revolution, and how we've gone from extremely low income per person in the early 1800s and extremely low life expectancy to really across the world with, I guess, the exception of sub-Saharan Africa, a much more developed world. So you can play this visualization. You can see the different countries. Each of these dots is a country. And the size of the circle represents the population of that country. So you can see countries become, as they're moving to the right, becoming more, developing a broader and more successful economy, higher GDP. Now, I want you to watch if you see that big jump downwards, that was the First World War. You'll see the Second World War coming up here in a second. You see everything moves backwards and it's a very violent shift, as countries will go through war and life expectancy drops. And then, of course, in the modern era, here we are today. Now, as a whole, this is an interesting story, and it's interesting to see the entire world and how these different countries interact with each other and how they've moved from this lower quadrant to the top right quadrant. But also, it's interesting just to look at individual countries. So for instance, if I take China as an example and play, it's one of the most fascinating things. Of course, everybody knows that, just kind of the basic economic strokes of China. But if you watch just the drastic movements of the country, it's amazing. And the growth from really one of the poorest countries in the world to really one of the most dynamic economies in the world is pretty rapid, starting around the 1970s. And before that, you see the Great Leap Forward right there, which is really Great Leap Backward. And then you see the development happen, in really from 1990s forward. So it's amazing to think that a country can move from essentially a agrarian, completely deindustrial society to a really first world economy in such a small amount of time. Now, visualizations don't always have to be so serious, and they don't always necessarily need to inform you about a topic. Sometimes they can just engage you about something that you already know. This is one of my favorite visualizations as well. I guess these all are, so I probably shouldn't say that, but I like to say it because every time I see it, I get excited about it. Not just because it's built beautifully, but also because it shows something that we all understand, which is simply that Walmart has grown exponentially from just this small single store in Bentonville, Arkansas. And you would think, oh yeah, well, Walmart's just always been around. It's always been pervasive. It's always just been a part of our society, and it continues to grow. But the truth is, for a very long time, I mean, really until the mid-70s and early 80s, it was really just a southern, midwestern phenomenon, a store. And so it's easy to think that it's just always been everywhere, but the truth is that it hasn't. And this visualization is one of those ones that you can just watch, and it's fascinating to see the way that Walmart grew. And you can see the green dots now, and those are Sam's Clubs as opposed to Walmart's as they're popping up. Now, something that's very interesting here is that there's only 1,200 stores in 1989, really 1,500 in 1990. By the end of the 2010s, there's going to be more than 4,000 stores. It's just amazing. 1,000 in 1990 to 4,000 in 20 more years. It's just amazing to think about, especially in the context of all of the local discussions that go on about Walmart and about, is it okay to let Walmart into this town? Is it okay to let it into our city? I lived in a small town in Washington, and our city council decided not to let Walmart in, and then 6 months later decided to let Target in. So it's like they think there's this huge difference, but really there's not. But in any case, I think that, so this isn't something that you need to know. It's not something that is necessarily informing you of something that you didn't already know, but it's showing you information that you've already known in a way that is so engaging and interactive that you kind of want to share it. You kind of want to tell other people about it, and you want to play with it. In a way that just somebody saying, oh yeah, there's 4,000 Walmarts. Okay. I don't care. You know. So this interaction with data and this engagement with it is a fascinating use of interactive charts and graphs. And of course, like I was saying before, it doesn't always have to be serious. Sometimes it can be about something that's a little bit more lighthearted or maybe less, socially important. And this is a visualization that essentially shows for each of these different events in the Olympics, the time between the first, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth place people in each of these events. Now, when you look at the x-axis of this visualization, so along it, you can see, okay, well, this person is only a quarter of a second behind the winner, and they're in fourth place. Okay, that's great. And you can perceive it, and the visualization is helpful, but at the same time, it's hard to perceive in your mind exactly how close that is. So you can actually play this and you can hear the difference between first, second, third, fourth, etc. So that was the difference between first and 22nd place in men's downhill, less than a second and a half. And this is in for the 2010 Olympics. It's amazing to think about. And again, this is something that you know, you understand, yes, these races are very close, but you don't really recognize how close it is. I mean, the difference between 22nd and maybe even 4th place is really just maybe tucking a little bit tighter, turning the corner a little bit tighter. It's just amazing to think that it's that close. And before I saw this, I never really even thought it was something that I should look into or be interested in. But the person that built this visualization, they took the time to dissect what was important about the visualization and really tell a story with it, which is that the difference is so much smaller than you can even think or even understand by looking at the visualization itself. Now, all of these visualizations I've shown you have been Flash or HTML5, and that's fantastic. And if you have the skills and you have the know-how to create visualizations like that, like this with those tools, then you're empowered. I mean, you can go out and create something as amazing as this, as engaging as this Walmart viz, and as informative as the Gapminder. But the problem is that, to be truthful, maybe not in this room, but in the populace as a whole, that's maybe 99% of the population, 95% of the population that's excluded. It doesn't seem like it, but I mean, that's really the truth. How many people really know how to program something like this in Flash and make it work exactly how they want it to? Furthermore, what about the time it takes to create something like this? Even if you're extremely talented, it takes time. It takes a lot of time to create an interactive visualization and put it on the web, which is why people haven't really done it yet. And it's really been still, even with these technologies, it's been for the enterprise, just like video was. Because you have to hire somebody to do it, or you have to literally take the time and learn it yourself. Now, IBM has taken that problem, and about 3 or 4 years ago, they came out with ManyEyes, which is a tool for taking data and then uploading it to the web and turning it into an interactive visualization. So it's powerful because essentially you're taking all of the complex technical steps out of the creation process and giving all of the power to the user through the interface of essentially the website. So let me show you a little bit of how it works. Essentially, you upload a data set, and then you can create a visualization from from that data set, just by kind of clicking on the different pieces that you'd like to visualize. So in this case, I had one picked out here, but, oh, there we go. So this is unemployment in South Africa. So I'm just going to click on it. This is something that somebody else has uploaded, but I can have access to that just like everybody can. So it's kind of a public forum for creating visualizations you can think of. You can think of it like that. And then you can click visualize and choose different types of visualizations that you'd like to turn this data into. So in this case, I'll just choose a bar chart. And then it's Java, so I always get that annoying reminder. So I can switch between different age groups to see unemployment among that group in South Africa. Now, it's pretty simple, I'll admit, and maybe not something that you'd be interested in doing, and maybe you'd want to go the extra mile and create that Flash visualization, but at the same time, it's also powerful because you can take this and embed it in any blog or website. So you can take something that's completely non-interactive, which is just a spreadsheet, or maybe even a static visualization. You can turn it into something that people can interact with and engage with, and then you can share it. Let me show you a visualization that somebody's actually made with ManyEyes to kind of illustrate this. Now, I've been talking about visualizations that are very widely understandable and widely important. They're things that if everybody isn't interested in them, they'd at least know about them. But the truth is that not everything is the Olympics. Not every single story is something that everybody is going to care about. But that doesn't mean that those aren't important stories to be telling. This is a visualization that shows basically the tweet stream for an Irish election. And this person, they don't necessarily have any technical skills, but they're running this blog and they want to show people with this word cloud basically how often different terms are mentioned. So the bigger the word, the more often the word is mentioned. Simple, local, to the point. And of course, I mean, completely honest with you, I don't care at all about this visualization. It's not something that inspires me, but that's okay. It's not my local data. There is local data for me that I would love to visualize like this. I'd love to visualize my local elections exactly like this. And so What about those situations where you've got data and you want to share it and make it interactive and engage people with it, but you don't necessarily have an enormous audience that you can spread the costs out over? So that's kind of the area that many has filled. Now, I've explained Flash, HTML5, more complex technologies that people can use to create visualizations with, and I've explained ManyEyes, which is really very simple and also kind of limited. You basically get what it gives you, so to speak. But there's definitely an enormous area in the middle where there's space for a tool that is maybe a little bit more complex than ManyEyes, but at the same time is a lot more powerful and more akin to the visualizations that you could create with a Flash type of tool. And that's the area that we've really been going after at Tableau Public and trying to educate people or enable people to create visualizations in. And we're really excited about it because we think that, truthfully, anymore, 90, 95% of the population is somewhat technical, computer literate, able to create different things and work with spreadsheets, but they're not quite to the point where they're able to create Flash visualizations. So we essentially created Tableau Public for them to be able to do that. Now, if you had a night like I had last night, you're probably a little bit interested in this visualization. It essentially shows for different beers, the number of calories per 100 milliliters and the percent of alcohol at the same time. So you can see the different types of beers that and how they basically their alcohol content and where they stand in proportion to other beers. Now, you can see some of the ice beers, as you will, are the ones that are the higher alcohol content for lower calories per 100 milliliters. And the funny thing is, you know, this is one of those things that why would you ever visualize this? Why would you ever take the time, right? But since it's simple and straightforward, why not? Why not share? Why not have a good time with it? Why not entertain with the data? Why not inspire people to just think about things like this? It's one of those things that you would never take the time to do unless you had an easy way of accomplishing that. Now, that people have definitely used Tableau Public for more serious things as well. This is a visualization by Peter Aldous of The New Scientist. Actually, let me reload it here so we can interact with it. And essentially what it's showing is he created this actually a year ago, right after the Fukushima nuclear disaster and the tsunami in Japan. And he was trying to answer a very simple question, which is, where are the nuclear power plants? How many are around us? Are they near to where I live? Are they dangerous? Are they the type that were in at Fukushima? These are classic questions that anybody would be curious of asking. And actually, I'll click on East Asia so we can see the different ones. And here you can see the reactor in Fukushima is a boiling water reactor. So that's a type. And these are the different ways of essentially cooling the reactors you can see down here as types. So you can see that in Japan, that's one of the most common types, the boiling water. And although that type is actually inherently safe, it is interesting to think about. In Europe, however, we can look at a type that maybe necessarily isn't quite as safe, which is the, I have to actually click on shutdown here so I can remember which one it is. So it's the light water cooled graphite moderated type, which was at Chernobyl. And essentially, because this was graphite moderated, graphite is actually it's the type of reactor. It's cooled with sodium and graphite, and sodium is actually explosive. So one of the reasons why, or actually the reason why Chernobyl melted down and then exploded was because of the type of cooling. And you can see, I can unselect the shutdown reactors and I can see only those that are operating. You can see that Russia still operates 3 reactors of that exact type to this day. Now, obviously, they've probably changed how they run them, but at the same time, it's interesting to think that they're still running today. Now, one of the powerful things about Tableau Public and that makes it fun to use is that you can take other people's visualizations that they've created and you can kind of use the data to create your own view. So I can actually download Peter's visualization here and use the data itself to visualize. This is going to take a while, but it's a good thing I already downloaded it. So I'm just going to open this up in Tableau Public. Excuse me, I'm sorry. So this is what the visualization looks like. So Tableau Public is a desktop client essentially that you can use to create visualizations. And this is the view that Peter has created and with the different interactive snippets that you can use and create and interact with. Now, I think a simple question to ask would be, well, where's the nearest nuclear reactor to here and how is it cooled? What sort of cooling system does it use? And, are there any nuclear plants that are being constructed now? So this is essentially what it looks like in Tableau to create a visualization. You can simply double-click on different features, and you can drag and drop them to visualize, essentially. And as you're dragging and dropping, Tableau automatically creates the visualization that makes the most sense given the different pieces that you've outlaid. So you can see I've created essentially a visualization that shows the generating capacity for all of these different plants over the world. I'm going to filter down to just the U.S. because, of course, for us, that story is the most interesting, and we've already seen all of the data for the rest of the world. As I switch from different pieces or different places in the visualization, I can change it on the fly and actually not have to be thinking about, oh, okay, well, now I need to go through this wizard to move that over there and to do that sort of thing. It's all kind of on at the speed as you're thinking of it, which is a really powerful thing if you think about it, because you're able to not get engaged in the how I'm creating this, but the what I'm creating with it. So we can see the different types of reactors in the U.S. We've got pressurized water and boiling water, so none of the type at Chernobyl, but pressurized water is the same as Fukushima. You can see we've got a couple of reactors here in Texas as well. So when I've got something like this, of course, the next step that anybody would want to do is share a finding and allow other people to interact with the data and learn from it. So I can bring this out onto a dashboard, add a title, call it the nuclear reactors in the U.S. And then I can add pieces of interactivity that allow people to work with the visualization and ask questions of it. So I can enable, for instance, a filter that allows people to say, well, I'd only like to see those reactors that were created, were starting to be constructed at a certain time. And this in itself is actually a really interesting story, because I always had the perception that we were kind of always adding nuclear plants and it was just one of those things that were being built as normal. But the truth is, if you filter back here to 2000, you can see the visualization hasn't changed at all. Go back to 1990, again, hasn't changed at all. 1980. Again, hasn't changed at all. Go back to 1970, and you can see a good deal of the reactors go away. So what this tells us is that a lot of the nuclear reactors in the U.S., a good portion of them, the ones that you're looking at right here, were built before 1970. In other words, they're over 40 years old. And most nuclear reactors at this time were designed and built to last around 40 years. Now, this isn't to say that they aren't safe, because they are safe, within reason, but it's an interesting thing to think about, that we've got this massive amount of power generating capacity in the U.S. that is essentially going to be coming offline or will need to be drastically rebuilt in the near future. And then once I have this view, I won't actually show you actually do it, because this internet is horrible, but I can essentially save it to the web, and then I can embed that in any blog or websites, just like Peter's done here. And see, I click the share button, essentially I just get a piece of JavaScript. So Tableau Public took this idea of, okay, well, ManyEyes was really simple and easy to use for everybody, which is great, because it allows anybody to put data on the web, but at the same time, it's not as powerful as Flash, but Flash, of course, is too complex and difficult for most people to use. So with Tableau, it's kind of in the middle, and you're able to get exactly the view that you want and change it and change the formatting and change the fonts and change how things are arrayed. But at the same time, you don't necessarily have to be, well, you don't at all have to be writing calculations and you don't have to have any programming skills to do it, I guess is what I'm saying. So, there we go. So where does that leave us today? After we've kind of seen the three, well, I guess you could call them the major tools for putting data on the web today. First of all, visualizations can engage. So you saw the gapminder visualization and how engaging it was, about data that you would never even think about in a normal circumstance, and yet it's so amazing to see and to click on your country and to see its progress over time, becoming a less developed country to a more developed country. Visualizations can inform, just like the Walmart visualization. They can tell us something in a way, or they can tell us something that we already knew in a way that we never had interacted with it before. And of course they can entertain, just like the beer visualization or the Olympics viz. And they can be for anything from the most global subject, like the visualization that Peter showed, the nuclear reactors, to the most local, small, just your school, just your neighborhood, your block. So I'm not going to pretend, of course, that I can predict the future, but there are definitely some trends and some things that are going to continue happening in this space and that are going to make visualizations easier for everybody to use. The first of all is, first one is web-based creation. This is kind of the direction that we're going with Tableau Public, and I think in general people will expect things to be able to be created on the web, and they'll expect it to be not just on the web, but also full-featured. So it's kind of that dichotomy of you have tools that you can use on the web, but they're relatively simple and maybe easy to use, which is really good. But at the same time, if they're not powerful, then you're still being left with half of the picture. So as we put more technology on the web and more technology for visualizing on the web, it'll have to be even easier for people to use too, because the point isn't to make something that is incredibly complex and that 1% of the population can use. It's something that is full-featured and everybody can use. And of course, we're going to see visualizations everywhere. Now, 5 years ago, if you looked up interactive visualization, you'd just get basically nothing. You'd maybe see a couple of flash visualizations. But now, if you look it up, you get thousands and thousands of different things that you can view and interact with and touch on the internet. And we've only scratched the surface. I mean, data is truly everywhere. It surrounds us. We interact with it every day, and yet it's not on the web. So we have the data, we have the tools, so the only step now is really for people to begin using that data and for everybody to kind of become a data lover and a data rock star. Anyway, so somebody always told me if you want to make friends with an audience to end a little bit early, but I'd love to ask any questions, or I'd love for you to ask me any question that you have about the topic, and I'll do my best to answer. I'm obviously not an expert on everything, but I would love to talk about the subject in general, and yeah.
Hi.
Not on. Do you have any favorite sort of data sets? When something comes across your desk and you go, I want to visualize that, and what are some of the common elements of those sets that you make?
That's a great question. So just to repeat, in case anybody didn't hear, he was asking what sorts of data sets I love and I think I have to create a visualization with that. The first one is pretty straightforward, and I think a lot of people in this room would feel the same way as I about it, and that's social media data. I mean, it's just so amazing to see, be able to look up a particular hashtag and using the Twitter API to get that data and then create a visualization from it. And whenever I see something that's kind of going to be happening, I always try to look up the hashtag and record it so that I can go back later and visualize the data. And actually, I'll show you an example of a visualization that I used using some Twitter data. Feel free to walk up to the mic if you have any questions. I'm just going to look up this visualization so I can have a little bit of context to what I was just saying. But the other thing, too, that I find really fascinating, especially around election year, is, of course, election data. And in some ways, it's not really as public as it should be, and that's can be kind of frustrating because it's difficult to get it. But we've been looking at some super PAC data lately, and it's really pretty fascinating how much money is being just funneled through these organizations, and second of all, how negative they are. We're looking at the super PAC that essentially is backing Mitt Romney, and the super PAC spends 90% of what it takes in on basically, well, actually, it's pretty much just against one candidate, which is Rick Santorum and a little bit on Newt Gingrich and just denouncing him and running smear ads essentially. So this is a visualization I created a while ago on tweets around the launch of the iPhone 4S. And you can see, well, first of all, the geographic distribution, which is interesting, but also just the everybody thought it was going to be the iPhone 5, but of course it ended up being the iPhone 4S. So you can see the different hashtags switch as people found out. And then the thing that caused this to drop off so far, you would think that it was because people just stopped talking about it, but it was actually because this was, I think the 6th was when Steve Jobs died. So, people actually stopped tweeting about the iPhone. Yeah.
Hi, thanks. This has been a really good talk. I'm interested in how you handle incredibly complex and different data sets and how the software knows the right kind of data visualization to create. With map data, it's clear, but when you're getting out into different kinds of data, how does the system
do that? Yeah, that's a great question. So essentially, Tableau takes the columns in your database. So let's say that just using an example of an Excel spreadsheet, because that's really the easiest to think about. Actually, let me just open up Tableau so I can show you. And it turns those columns into the different fields that you see on the left-hand side here. So each one of these is just a column in an Excel spreadsheet. And it takes, it actually has a tool in it, which I had hidden before, that takes the different pieces that you've selected. So if I select, for example, a date and a numerical value, you can see that it's highlighted this view over here, which is a time series. So there actually is, it is fairly easy to discern within some accuracy the correct chart type for certain types of data. But the nice thing is that if I decide that, oh, okay, I don't want to use that type, I want to use an area chart, I want to split this up by type, these are all things that are possible just by changing your mind and working analytically. Because you're right, it's not easy to just say, oh yeah, that's it, that's the one. That's what makes Excel so frustrating is that if you're using the chart wizard, you have to go through 10, 15 steps and then you realize, wait, hold on, I want to do that differently. So we kind of took the approach of, instead of giving you the answer, we'll provide a solution and then you can choose different solutions if you want to explore.
One follow-up question. How do you handle multiple data sources?
So that's a good question. You can connect to as many data sources as you want, and as long as you have a common identifier between them. So for instance, let's say you have data on state and sales by state, and then you have another data set that has territories assigned by those states. So you can join on state and then use them together. And you can also just perform a SQL join if you want to on things like that.
Thank you.
Very welcome. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, the question is, does Tableau, is it able to connect to data streams that will automatically update? So essentially you just publish it and then it takes the updated data. And the answer is no, unfortunately. However, you can update the visualization as much as you want. So the Twitter visualization I showed you, obviously that's something that you'd like to just hook up and have it automatically update. I just updated that, republished it essentially every 6 hours for a couple of days. And it essentially, it's just a two-step process and relatively straightforward. Although, obviously, that would be a nice feature and something that we've explored and might continue to explore if we can find the funds to develop it. Yeah. Did you say a hierarchy? So are you thinking of something like an organizational chart where you've got different nodes coming off that? So you could use Tableau to do that, definitely. So it's in a database, you were saying, as well? Yeah, so Tableau connects to different database technologies as well. Yeah, so it's not only statistics. It's basically any data that you have an interest in, you can use it to create a visualization. Obviously, there's more to it than that. I'd love to talk to you afterwards if you'd like, and I'll explain a little bit more in detail. Other questions?
Thank you. Some of the visualizations that we saw were kind of animations, so it animated time rather than putting that on a chart.
Yeah.
Is that something that's provided in the software that you can basically have it execute it?
Absolutely. So let me actually show you, rather than tell you, because I always find that so boring. So I can just drag this construction started date up to pages, and you can see when I hit the play button here, show history, the different reactors as they're coming up are animated. Now, I can actually, I don't actually want to do that. I want to show all of my, all the different history there. So you can see them as they're added.
Okay.
Yeah. Other questions?
Do you have any thoughts on, in the future, that we'll have visualizations be more pervasive and it'll be out there? Any concerns about manipulation of data? If something's pretty, we're more likely to love it and believe it right off the bat. And if there's more of it, any concerns there?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think that it's one of those things, you know, it's, do you trust anybody to make a documentary about a very difficult subject? You know, Michael Moore's a great example. Now, he exposes lots of problems in our world using video, right? But at the same time, that doesn't mean that everything he says is exactly 100% accurate. So it's kind of the same thing with data. So there's a lot of room for manipulation and for people to take data and turn it into something that it's not. Our philosophy, you know, not that that's the only thing that matters, but our philosophy is just to make it easy for people to not essentially show the wrong thing. But of course, you know, if you have the need and desire, you can manipulate it any way you want. I think on balance, though, the growth and the explosion that has been happening in data visualization is a really powerful positive trend. And if only for the reason that people are more informed about the world that they're in. And I think that's, you know, an important thing. So did I answer all your questions? You had a couple of different pieces in there. Any other questions?
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering where you're pulling the map images. Are they from Google? Also, I'm wondering if those images can be swapped out for customized maps, like or satellite maps that, you know, an organization might create in-house.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So it's a WMS server. So you can use any OGC compliant WMS server as the background. So I can actually go in here and change the background map. And I can also change it, you know, just using our standard one. I can change it to different backgrounds, different colors, and I can add streets and highways as an example. So, the nice thing about, I won't go into all of the things that go into WMS servers, but the nice thing is there are basically layers of different information. So you're essentially just seeing an image, but I can layer different pieces of data on top of it using the server itself. So it's a really powerful way, and you can use different images if you'd like. The only caveat there is that it has to be this projection. So a lot of times people don't want to use this projection because it can be a little bit distorting. Antarctica isn't that big, but of course, in most cases, that's not really a huge problem.
Open and shared data. What about other sorts of data, maybe with a customer, like where you'd want more privacy?
That's a great question. So, we developed Tableau Public from a tool called Tableau Desktop. It's the same UI. And essentially what it is, it's a business intelligence tool for people to, do exactly the same thing and then share it, but, with data that they don't want to publish to the internet. To explain that, I'm glad you brought it up, actually. The reason why we did Tableau Public is because, you know, just internally in Tableau, we really love data and we're kind of excited about data, but at the same time, you know, it's wonderful for us to, you know, whenever somebody uses this, you know, that our name's on the web, and that is a really a big positive for us, and it helps us to sell other software. But obviously, the tool itself is completely free. Tableau Public is completely free. So.
Any suggestions for mining public data?
Yeah, that can be a challenge. So the question is mining public data. And, you know, be honest, I think that it's one of those things that you have to be, usually it's a patience thing for me. And just being able to separate out the pieces of data that you need to find and then kind of making a replicable process. I know that this sounds so obvious, but when you initially are getting down, like, for instance, I've taken SEC forms and turned them into data before, which is essentially just manually compiling and takes forever. And you just need to get a really good process down to be able to make that work. And then the other end of that, of course, is public data that's well provided and actually in a nice format. So unfortunately, I think it may still be up, but data.gov is a wonderful source to find these data sets. And you can kind of, actually, you can see we're kind of proud they put us on the front page there. But anyway, data.gov is a really good source for data sets on the government. And they're usually really nicely compiled and formatted. Not always, of course. But and then the second thing is that even though I guess I've been a little negative on Excel, it's still a fantastic tool for data transformation. And another tool that is really powerful for cleaning data once you have it is Google Refine. So if you're interested in looking into that, I think it's a tool that is really powerful, but it's also highly technical. So depending on how excited you are about the data, there's a lot of tools available to turning it into something really useful. But as with all government projects, it can be laden with bureaucracy and difficult to get, difficult to use. So that's my suggestions, however they are.
It's a great presentation. I was wondering how deep the styling or presentation options go.
Yeah, that's a great question. And I was talking about the ability to change that I didn't really show, which is probably a bad thing. So, well, first of all, I've kind of messed everything up here, but let me get back to something that actually looks like. Okay, so first of all, one thing that's really important for the web and putting data on the web is, of course, sizing it, right? Because you always have this issue of, well, I only have so much space on my blog, or I only have so much space on my website. So the first thing I would say is that it's very easy to size Tableau to be exactly how you want it to be. And then you can change all of these different pieces to be exactly as you want it. So if I want to change fonts, I want to change size of fonts, I want to do any of that, that's all easily available. And then I can change the colors in the background so I don't have to go with the white, things like that. And I can actually, there's different ways that I can manipulate the tool as well to create different interactions. So for instance, you can use, this is only showing one sheet, but you could use multiple pieces of a visualization to interact with other pieces, which is pretty interesting when you think about it. Let me actually bring this out and I'll kind of show you an example. So if I bring this other sheet that I just created out, I can use this one at the top to filter down to only those pieces that are in that visualization. So you have not only a lot of control over how it looks and the fonts and things like that, but you also have control over how people interact with it, which at the end of the day is just as important, if maybe not as widely thought about. So. Well, great. Looks like I've exhausted you. Thank you all so much for coming. Really appreciate it. And I hope you learned something.